This is the River Radius, a cultural nexus of rivers, people, and boats. I am your host, Sam Carter. Welcome.
This is actually a really interesting moment for rivers and for dams. Internationally, we've really seen that dams have started to fall out of favor. We're really several years in the running, seeing basically a decline in new dams going up. Trends really are in favor of rivers. And also, excitingly, hopefully we're at the beginning of a new trend in dams actually coming out.
Today's episode comes to you from the work to remove dams from rivers. For many decades, dams were considered clean energy because a dam could create electricity by using falling water in a turbine, and in the early stages of electrical infrastructure development, dams were a consistent source of electricity. Dams were also considered valuable infrastructure because they stored water for municipal, agricultural, and industrial use, and dams were touted as a tool to reduce flood hazards in some places. But these characteristics are revealing a different story after decades of larger dams blocking rivers. Dams will store water in reservoirs, and these reservoirs can release methane gas, a powerful climate-influencing gas. Reservoirs can create algae, starving the water of oxygen in the reservoir and the downstream river environment. Rivers need to have flow to keep water clean and at the temperature range endemic for that river. Dams change the temperature of water in the rivers, influencing the necessary temperatures needed for native fish. And dams block the open passage of water and aquatic life in the rivers. Dams can also force the displacement of communities where a reservoir will be formed. Global estimates offer that there are about 50,000 large dams around the world. A large dam is one that is at least 50 feet tall. The United States has about 9,000 of these large dams. China has the most large dams at about 23,000. There is also a category of major dams. These are larger than large dams, and there are about 300 of these major dams globally. Major dams are measured by several factors to include height, volume of the reservoir, and power production. The biggest major dam in the world by power production is the Three Gorges Dam in China on the Yangtze River, with a length of almost 1.5 miles across. And the biggest major dam in the United States by power production is the Grand Coulee Dam on the Columbia River, a dam that is almost 1 mile across. Beyond the major and large dams, the United States is estimated to have another 70,000 dams of smaller size. Some of these are active dams providing modern infrastructure services, and some are relics that simply block rivers or streams and were established hundreds of years ago for mills and other uses. In the United States, the trend is more and more towards not building new dams, and a trend is happening to remove dams when and where appropriate. Today, we will learn about three rivers in the United States and the work to remove dams at those rivers. And we will also hear about the status of dam construction internationally. Those rivers in the United States are the Chattooga River in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, the Klamath River in California and Oregon, and the Snake River forming in Wyoming with its terminus in Washington. Our guest to look at global rivers is the organization International Rivers. We will start with the vastly popular topic of the Klamath Dam removal. The Klamath River flows from southern Oregon near Crater Lake, then into California and southwest to the Pacific Ocean. There are 4 dams on the Klamath, and this dam removal project is well underway. To learn about the status of the largest dam removal project in the modern dam era, I spoke with a guest from an earlier River Radius episode, Wren Brownell from the Klamath River Renewal Corporation.
My name is Wren Brownell. I'm the Public Information Officer for the Klamath River Renewal Corporation, and I'm coming to you from the Klamath River in California.
Excellent. And tell me about your work. What do you do? What's the nature of the things you do?
So the Klamath River Renewal Corporation oversees the removal of the 4 lower hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River. And my job day to day is just to keep the public informed. So I'm out there with journalists, or I'm doing tours with the public or doing presentations, things like that, just so people are in the loop of how the project is progressing.
In the news, there's been several stories, lots of information from those journalists about what's going on with the dams, the removal of them. Can you give us the clear update? Which dams are still in place? Which ones are removed? And are any reservoirs holding water?
Yeah, so the first dam was actually removed last summer. That was COPCO number 2. It was the smallest of all the dams, and it was removed before the other ones because it was a diversion dam, so it didn't have a reservoir behind it. It also had a convenient location right below COPCO number one, which meant that we could kind of hold back the river flows during the removal of the dam. And there was a reservoir downstream, so we could maintain downstream flows and folks never saw any sort of interruptions downriver. And because of its small stature, the fact it didn't have a reservoir, we removed that one last summer. And then what we're in now is called the drawdown period. We finished the initial drawdown period, which was the slow draining of all the waters that were stored behind COPCO number one, J.C. Boyle up in Oregon, and then Iron Gate. The drawdown period, the initial phase, was completed in mid-February. So we drained all the water that was held back by the dams originally. But we're still technically in the larger drawdown period because they're drained at such a slow rate that there's the potential that we could get enough water into the system, right? A big snow melt or a lot of spring runoff that they could refill a little bit and we'll have to let them drain again. And we've seen that happen a little bit over the last couple months, right? When flows are increased, we'll see just a little bit of refill. They haven't refilled all the way, but we'll see a little bit refill and then they'll drain again. And right now we're getting into spring now. So we are starting to see some spring melt. I think Iron Gate has just a little bit of fill. We're talking about like 20 feet, right? Nowhere near the top or anything like that. But we won't get to work deconstructing, especially Iron Gate and J.C. Boyle, until the risk for any sort of spring flow event has completely subsided.
So to be clear, COPCO 2 is gone. COPCO 1, J.C. Boyle, and Iron Gate are all in place.
Yeah, but we were able to break ground on COPCO number 1 about a month ago. And that's because COPCO number 1 is a big concrete arch dam, while Iron Gate and J.C. Boyle are clay core earthen dams, which in essence means they're just a big pile of rocks. So COPCO 1, we could start deconstructing because if we had it halfway down, had a huge flow event, water could safely pass over the top of that partially deconstructed dam and the dam would remain in place. It'd be totally safe and fine. But with these earthen dams, again, just big pile of rocks, if we had them halfway taken apart and then a flow event happened that was big enough that they were overtopped, that could cause the dams to actually fall apart. It wasn't a safe condition. And so that's why they will stay at their full height until we're back to baseline flows on the Klamath River.
Today's sponsor is Paddleways, brought to you by NRS. The Paddleways app is your digital hub for all things paddling. Get access to real-time stream flows, weather, detailed maps with put-ins, takeouts, rapids, hazards, and camps, all for free. They have a paid subscription and that unlocks advanced features to help you plan and navigate with confidence even when you're off the grid and out of cell service. I use this paid subscription. It's awesome. Paddleways can even help you find a shuttle. And Paddleways is offering you a 25% discount on the paid version. To access this discount, download the app and then you have to use the website to actually check out with the discount code. Grab the discount link in our show notes, our link tree, and from the sponsor logo page on our website. Go to your favorite app store today and download Paddleways. I use it and I really appreciate it. The River Radius in this episode is sponsored by the Denver area Nissan dealers. Here is one of their featured vehicles.
Right now I'm driving a Nissan Rogue four-door SUV. Excellent clearance, big tires. This car is great for roads down to the river that are bumpy, rutted, rocky, muddy, slippery, all the interior comfort features you're looking for, all kinds of safety features, and it gets awesome fuel economy. 36 miles to the gallon on the highway, 29 in the city.
You can find your Denver area Nissan dealers online at www.nissanusa.com and on Instagram at NissanUSA. I'm curious about the sediment because dams collect sediment. That's just part of what happens. Mm-hmm. And some of those dams, 100 years, 60 years, varying lengths for each of these dams. What's up with sediment in the Klamath River downstream of these dams?
So COPCO 1 was in place for over 100 years, right? Iron Gate was the last to be built. It was completed in around 1962. And since these dams have been in place, they've been impounding sediment. And that sediment that's coming downstream, that sediment is being contributed by tributaries, right? Because sediment's a natural part of a river system. So sands and gravels would usually be going downstream and usually be entering the river from these tribs. that hasn't been able to. So some of it is impounded natural river sediments, but the vast majority of it is dead algae, right? Because these reservoirs, they set out in, under the hot sun, they'd be, create these big algae blooms, the algae would die and it'd sink to the bottom. And at the Kapka Reservoir, that's been happening for over 100 years, right? So altogether, there's about 15 to 17 million cubic yards of impounded sediment behind the dams. Again, the vast majority of it being dead algae. And during the drawdown process, we estimate that about 5 to 7 million cubic yards of sediment will go downstream. And that is on average what the Klamath River moves any given year.
Part of the reason I asked the question is because I have heard kickback from people complaining about the amount of sediment downstream, that the river was extra dirty, right? You're saying that that's the amount of sediment that it would move in a year, but it's been condensed into a shorter time. Has that kind of like initial sediment dirtying of the river cleared out?
It's cleared up considerably. And you're right. Like the big difference is like that average usually takes place over the course of an entire year. And what we did is we put it in over this truncated period. We knew that there would be impacts to that, right? The biggest impact is that whenever you put a lot of sediment or a lot of material into the water, right, it takes up all the space in the water, and then there's not enough space for the water to hold oxygen itself, right? So it creates issues with dissolved oxygen. And we knew that that would happen. And so that's specifically why we timed drawdown to occur in January, February. It was actually like fisheries-focused agencies like NOAA or U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and then river tribes who directed us to do drawdown when we did, when there'd be the least amount of species in the main stem of the river, particularly the species that we're trying to recover. Because when we dumped all that sediment into the river, it crashed dissolved oxygen, particularly for the stretch between Iron Gate and Syed Valley. And so we did see a 24-hour period of 0% dissolved oxygen in the river during that time. But since then, it's bounced back. That occurred, but ever since then, we've been hovering anywhere between 80 to 90% DO, and the river has cleared up considerably. And the reality is that it will continue to look kind of murky until we successfully get vegetation established out in the reservoir. The vast majority of sediment has already been sent downstream, but until we get vegetation successfully established out in the former reservoir footprints, we'll continue to see kind of murky conditions.
So tell us more about the ReVeg project. I recall learning that there was millions of seeds, potentially even a few billion seeds collected. There's an enormous effort going to revegetate the land that was a reservoir so that it doesn't get inundated by weeds, whatever that might be. How is that project going of replanting seeds?
The revegetation is done in a collaboration between our main restoration contractor, Resource Environmental Solutions, and then they have a partnership with the Yurok tribe. For about 5 years prior to beginning the dam removal, the Yurok tribe was out collecting native plant seeds, all from the area around the reservoirs or near the Klamath. I think that they had a bad acorn year for black oaks, so some of them were harvested off of the Rogue, but really the bulk of the species all came from around the Kopco, Iron Gate, and J.C. Boyle reservoirs. And they collected about 13 million native seeds by hand, and then those were propagated. And that's why we have 17 billion seeds now. And so phase one of revegetation is done. And all that means is that they've coated the reservoirs. All of them have been seeded. They didn't use up all 17 billion seeds. That's kind of their cache because this is going to be an iterative process, right? To make sure that every square foot has some vegetation on it out in that reservoir. There's 2,200 acres of exposed reservoir footprint that need that restoration treatment. And so this spring, they laid down 65,000 pounds of seed across the three reservoirs. And I think they planted somewhere around 70,000 bare rootstock plants as well. And they had to get all that seed down before we kind of got into spring. And now stuff is growing out there already. And it's really exciting to see.
Was that done by hand?
The majority of it was done by hand by those Yurok crews. There was some aerial seeding too, because there's certain cliffy edges that were too dangerous for crews to walk on. And then out in the Kopco Reservoir, there's a lot of cold water springs that used to seep up underneath the reservoir, but now are, you know, exposed and feeding down into the river. And there's just a lot of more moisture out in that reservoir. And so some of the areas were a little guckier for longer and crews couldn't safely walk along those. So that was also aerially seeded.
So have you seen, I don't want to say this is all about salmon and salmon having their waterway back and their ability to get back to the mountains and spawn and be prolific, but a lot of it seems to be about salmon. Have you seen salmon returns yet? Is anything changing with salmon habits? Changing meaning return to like pre-dam conditions.
Just not quite yet, right? Like I said, our drawdown period was specifically scheduled to be when we had the least salmonids around. And so right now is when the juveniles are starting their out-migration. And we are seeing healthy, like I've heard from CDFW and the Cudahy tribe who are doing salmon monitoring right now, that they're seeing healthy salmon out in the river and that the oldest fish are doing really well. We are entering the kind of the cusp of the season where spring Chinook are going to start heading upstream, but they're still down, you know, around Rekla, right? They're entering the mouth of the river in around late April, May. So they're just starting their migration upstream. But this project poses a lot of benefits for those spring Chinook in particular. The last wild stronghold of them is on the Salmon River, one of the tributaries to the Klamath. And their numbers are pretty dismal, but they probably comprise the majority of the salmon population in the upper basin. And so this project has big benefits for them long term. I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, for the last couple of years, they've been somewhere between 90 to 200 fish is the amount they've been counting. But they also exist up the Trinity. So I just should note that is that there are spring Chinook salmon that live up the Trinity River as well.
From KRRC's standpoint, when do you all feel like this project is done? I mean, I guess, and maybe that's when, like, when do you all stop your work to be a part of this?
Well, I guess I'll start with the small scale goals. The dams are going to be fully removed by sometime this fall. So that's when the dam removal itself will be complete. The restoration will be ongoing for several years. Our restoration contractor, they'll be on site working on revegetation until it is successfully established. And it isn't, they don't determine when that is. KRRC and regulators and agencies are the ones who determine when that job is done. Permitting wise, we have permitting obligations for water quality monitoring going out over 7 years down the line. Even when the dam removal is done this fall, restoration will be ongoing, research will be ongoing. I think it's important to keep in mind that dam removal is just the start. The removal of these dams was the most immediate thing that we could do to save salmon populations on the Klamath River and the most immediate thing we could do to improve the health of the communities that live along the river. But a lot more restoration is needed after this. This was the most immediate step. It was the first thing we needed to do, but there's a lot more restoration needed to bring the Klamath River back to full health. So in a sense, the work will never be done.
All right. Well, that's all I have. Rin Brunell, thank you for coming on the podcast and talking about the Klamath.
Oh, thank you for having me.
On to our next river. In the southern corner of the Appalachian Mountains, the Chattooga River bears its headwaters at the eastern continental divide and rolls southeast. After about 50 miles of free-running river, the Chattooga runs into a lake created by Tugaloo Dam. This dam sits right below the confluence of the Chattooga River and the Tallulah River. Tugaloo Dam is part of the network of dams providing electricity for the Southern Company, a power company serving Georgia. The Chattooga is a wild and scenic river. It is known and respected for its whitewater runs and was one of the filming locations for the movie Deliverance. I was able to run the Chattooga a few years ago and was awestruck by the forest and sandy beaches and the clear water and the whitewater. To learn more about the work to remove the Tugaloo Dam, we talk with the Chattooga Conservancy. Please meet Nicole Haler.
My name is Nicole Haler. I'm located in the Chattooga watershed in Oconee County, South Carolina, which is in the upper far northwestern mountainous area of South Carolina. I'm the executive director of the Chattooga Conservancy, and our organization was coalesced in about 1994 to have a shot at moderating the Forest Service's timber harvesting program in the Chattooga River watershed. And we did this because the watershed is actually 70% public land contained in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia. And so it offered a prime opportunity to exercise our rights as citizens to influence Forest Service activities on public land.
Tell us about the Chattooga River and the Tallulah River, please.
The Chattooga River is unique and biologically rich. It's about 190,000 acres, of which about 70% is public land contained in the three national forests, in the Sumter National Forest in South Carolina, Chattahoochee National Forest in Georgia, and Nantahala National Forest in North Carolina. It's a national wild and scenic river and was designated in 1974 The source waters of the Chattooga begin at the apex of the Eastern Continental Divide, so it provides unparalleled clean water, which are classified as outstanding resource waters. It's also a global biological hotspot, and the uniqueness of the Chattooga is due largely to its great variation of elevations and landforms, and its very high annual rainfall. It's actually a temperate rainforest. And that's what gives rise to this unusual biological diversity. It's also close to some very populous areas within a couple of hours' drive of Atlanta, Georgia, Greenville, South Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina. So it's a destination area for millions of people in the Southeast. It's also an exemplary whitewater river with, you know, steep cascades. It's one of the most challenging whitewater runs in the Southeast. The Chattooga is known as the gem of the Southeast Wild and Scenic River System.
And then the Tallulah River. I know it's a different one. It's dammed up a lot. But tell us about the Tallulah side, please.
Yes, the Tallulah is at the tail end of a series of dams that were all put into place in the early 1900s through the Georgia Power Company, which is now the Southern Company. The high point of the Tallulah River is the Tallulah Gorge, and it's one of the most impressive natural wonders in the eastern United States. The gorge is about 800 feet deep in places, with spectacular waterfalls ranging from about 16 feet to almost 100 feet tall. The ecological niches that have developed in the gorge provide habitat for a really unusual array of plants and animals, including the rare persistent trillium. It's the only place it's found in the world. And then others like the peregrine falcon, green salamanders, white fringeless orchids. The efforts of organizations have prompted recreational whitewater releases in the Tallulah and also aesthetic releases. So folks get to enjoy it when it's not completely dewatered. And that has cast a greater spotlight on the wonders of the Tallulah River.
And so I want to know more then about the Tugaloo Dam. This is a dam that is right below the confluence of these two rivers, the Tallulah and the Chattooga. And the Chattooga Conservancy is working on having this dam removed, and that's a long project. Can you tell us about Tugaloo Dam? Let's start off with things like when it was built and why it was originally built, please.
The Tugaloo Dam was built in 1923, and it's about 155 feet high. And its purpose was hydroelectricity. And that's really its purpose today.
Is it producing a lot of electricity, or is it kind of a small contributor to the bigger system?
It's a very small amount of electricity. It's about 45 megawatts of power. So it's about 1% of Georgia Power's, you know, total generating capacity. Recently, Georgia Power got permission from FERC to upgrade the generating capacity of the turbines there, which we challenged during the FERC process, and we were unsuccessful in stopping that because we felt it would affect the objective evaluation of actually decommissioning the Tugaloo Dam when the relicensing process gets fully underway, which is going to start relatively soon in 2031.
Can you tell us the problems, the challenges that Tugaloo Dam is presenting to the river there that you all are aware of?
The Tugaloo Dam impounds the last 4 miles of the Chattooga and about the last 2 miles of the Tallulah, plus the confluence of these incredibly iconic, biologically rich rivers, and it inundates the habitat. The Tugaloo Dam, it blocks what would be a contiguous forested about 600 acres of native forest, which would connect the biological diversity of these two watersheds. It's a very old dam that we're not really abreast of the structural issues that could affect a 100-year-old dam, other than the ones you can see on the downstream side, like, you know, cracks and concrete peeling off. So I can't comment on that from a technical point of view. But the biological impacts are rather profound to inundate the bottom stretches of these two rivers.
The license, the approval for the Tugaloo Dam to stay in place was renewed recently. You all are looking forward to the next decade. You said 2031 is part of the process. I think 2036 is also part of it. Can you talk about that timeline and the work you all are doing to prepare for advocating for that dam removal?
Sure. First, I'd like to clarify the permit wasn't renewed.
Okay.
It was only modified because Tupelo Dam produces such a incredibly small amount of hydroelectricity. Georgia Power wanted to upgrade the turbines. In other words, the generating capacity of the turbines were quite old. So they basically wanted to replace some of the guts of the dam to squeeze out a little more of hydropower from it. They were limited on the increase in generating power without activating certain processes that would create more paperwork through the National Environmental Policy Act. So they increased the generating capacity just a little bit. It's quite expensive to do that. And we thought that the investment from Georgia Power to do this would prejudice the upcoming FERC relicensing hearings, which get underway in 2031. And what we're doing to prepare for that is we have worked with the University of Georgia to produce a study that could evaluate the information that's available right now to envision what the Chattooga River would look like underneath Lake Tupelo. Also, we're just commissioned a second study by the University of Georgia to actually produce a visualization, a digital rendering, a flyover of what the restored reach of the Chattooga would look like.
Talk a little bit more about the process. So you're working on all these studies. You're preparing information. Talk us through the timeline of things that come in the next bunch of years.
In the near future, we're going to work with UGA to complete the visualization, and we're also investigating the issue of sediment. And to us, that's the biggest problem that Georgia Power would have to address with removing the Tupelo Dam. There's a tremendous amount of sediment in Lake Tupelo, starting from about halfway up the lake, which is about 4 miles long. There are areas where it's only a couple feet deep. So there's a massive sediment load in that lake. So at the top of the watershed, you know, the greater Savannah River watershed, all this sediment, it can't be like the Klamath River where you just breach the dam and let the sediment flow in the Pacific Ocean. It's got a long way to go till it hits the Atlantic. So the sediment load is a technical issue that after we get through with the current UGA study, we're going to start looking at some technical studies that we can help address this problem.
And what kind of pushback are you anticipating as you move forward with this project, this idea to remove Tugaloo Dam?
It has some recreational use on it. There are no houses on it, but there is a fishing stocking program that Georgia DNR carries out, and it does get some use by low horsepower John boats, and there's some camping along the lake. So there'll be some social issues that people don't want to see the lake removed. And really, since we're not too far from the beginning of the relicensing process, it's not like we're broadcasting this. We have done quite a bit of social media posts on what it would be like to remove the Tupelo Dam, but it's not like we're experiencing a lot of pushback on that idea right now. And it's not a drinking water source, and it's not used for any sort of flood control. It is strictly an impoundment. The water level in it doesn't vary a whole lot. The water just goes over the top of the dam when it needs to go. And so there's no other uses for it other than the small amount of hydro that it will generate.
The study that University of Georgia has done, they're using technology that lets them understand what's under that lake, under that reservoir. That's a river, as a riverine section that hasn't been seen in 100 plus years. What is the understanding about what's underneath that water?
One of the key pieces of information that we've been able to obtain is a USGS survey that was done in 1903 that was a precursor to building the dam. And so there is some information available from that USGS survey. As an aside, I would mention that UGA asked Georgia Power for their historical data of the dam and what they could show prior to its construction, and they declined to provide their information.
So they have more information than the rest of the public.
Exactly.
Is Georgia Power a state organization, or is that a private company?
It's a private company.
Okay.
It's under the umbrella of a large energy providing company called the Southern Company. So one of the interesting things that this USGS survey showed right at the head of Lake Tuvalu, there was about a mile in between survey points. And if you actually go down there and, you know, and look at it, you can see it's a gorge section. And we think that the reason there was a mile in between the survey points is because it's basically inaccessible. You know, the surveyors just couldn't get down to the river. So we think that in the upper section, it is very steep, and it would be much like the Five Falls section of the Chattooga River, which is world famous for its beauty and its challenge. Down below the upper steep section, the riverbed, according to the survey, becomes a much gentler grade and could open up fishing, swimming, and other aesthetic beauty attributes. And UGA also used some high-tech tools like LIDAR and looking at the relief of the contours along the lake and then projecting what it would look like, also integrating that with the old USGS survey from 1903.
What I'm hearing is that if Tuvalu comes out, so the Tallulah side is well dammed and it will remain so, but the Chattooga side comes from the mountains. You said it comes from that apex of the Eastern Continental Divide, and it comes all the way down. It's free running. It's free flowing until it hits Tuvalu Dam. So taking out that dam just extends the free run of the Chattooga, creates more biodiversity, creates more landscape, riverscape that's healthy. And also, a fun side is it creates more awesome whitewater for people to go play on who want to be engaged like that.
We're hoping that it would add to an extension of the Wild and Scenic River Corridor. It would be prime for that. It's undeveloped on the South Carolina side on Lake Tuvalu. It's actually a natural heritage preserve. And on the Georgia side, it's Georgia Powerland or Forest Service land. It can't be emphasized enough how unique this area is due to its holdings of public land and also state parks like the Tallulah Gorge State Park and then the South Carolina Heritage Trust land. It's just a reflection of this whole area of the Southern Blue Ridge Escarpment, where we have these neighboring rivers like the Whitewater River, you know, which has the highest waterfall east of the Rockies on it, along with the Horse Pasture River, the Thompson River. It's an incredibly rich area due to its steepness, elevation changes, spray zones due to the waterfalls. And it would just strengthen the position of this area, you know, as a global biological hotspot. And restoring the land that's under the lake is really imperative for the health of the whole ecosystems.
Dams, we in the modern time, we understand now that dams are a real damaging effect to rivers, to all the aquatic health, even to the atmosphere with the release of methane. And it's simultaneously, I think it's important to recognize, or just to talk about for a minute, that those dams were put in place to create electricity in a time when electricity was not created many other ways. And the country was growing and there was a lot of waterways in the Southeast that could create electricity. And it was just by default of humans needing electricity that this happened.
Yes, the construction of those dams was strictly to feed the power demands, mainly from Atlanta. But now, as the issue of climate change has come to the fore, the advantages of removing, say, Lake Tuvalu and restoring 600 acres of native forest, which would act as a carbon sink as opposed to a source of greenhouse gases, certainly factors into our argument of why we should seriously consider decommissioning Tuvalu Dam and removing it. Removing this dam is completely feasible. There's no houses in Lake Tuvalu. It's not used for flood control. The benefits from biodiversity, recreation, economic values would be tremendous.
Nicole Haler and Chattooga Conservancy, thank you for your time and coming on the podcast to tell us about the Chattooga River, the Tallulah River, and Tuvalu Dam.
Thank you very much. We enjoyed doing it, and we look forward to hearing the other groups on your podcast.
The River Radius in this episode is sponsored by the Denver area Nissan dealers. Here is one of their featured vehicles.
Right now I'm driving a Nissan Rogue. It's a four-door SUV. Right now we're driving up a windy river canyon, cruising. Car handles so well. This thing passes with ease. There's a five-seater on the inside. You can throw your gear bags, your rig bags in the back hatch. Boats on the roof of this car. You can fold the back seats down and have a lot of room. It's a great vehicle to do the multitude of things you do in your life. Going to the river, camping, groceries, going on road trips, carrying all your friends to go somewhere, cleaning up and going somewhere nice. This is a smooth car. This thing will look good wherever you go.
You can find your Denver area Nissan dealers online at www.nissanusa.com and on Instagram at NissanUSA. This episode is sponsored by NRS Northwest River Supplies. NRS is from the great river state of Idaho and has been crafting paddling gear and boats for 50 plus years. Recently, I saw a picture of myself in my cold water river gear. So much is from NRS. My helmet, PFD, my dry suit, so many of my warm layers. NRS has always been in my rig bag and in my boat, and I'm glad for that. More importantly for me, ever since I started the River Radius 5 years ago, I have gained a glimpse of NRS behind the scenes, and they're so much more than a manufacturer. They provide cash money to river conservation groups, support dam removal projects, fund films, and work to build programs to increase paddling access to all. Plus, they've been a steadfast supporter of this podcast. NRS is consistently and humbly supporting you and your gear and all of our rivers. Find NRS in your local gear shop. Another river that has had strong attention towards removing the dams on that river is the Snake River. The Snake flows from Wyoming, creates the border between Idaho and Oregon, then flows west into Washington, where it joins the Columbia River. There are four dams on the Snake River. In the case of the Snake River dams, the effort is towards breaching of the dams, not removal. The four Snake River dams are massive concrete structures in the river on one side. The concrete structure houses the powerhouse and lock system. On the other side of the dam is earthen fill material, more simply an organized pile of rocks and rubble that is also holding back the river. Breaching means removing the rock and rubble and letting the river run free through this passage. The concrete structure is left in place and the powerhouse goes offline. This is a simple way to open up the river. To learn about the status of the effort to remove the Snake River dams, I spoke with a returning guest from two previous River Radius episodes, Libby Toby of the Grand Salmon Project.
My name is Libby Toby. I am based in Missoula, Montana currently, and I split my time between river guiding, swiftwater rescue instruction, kayak construction, and working more on the conservation side of things. So worked with the Idaho Conservation League this past winter as a legislative fellow, and I am anticipating starting law school in the fall with an eye towards public interest environmental law.
Would you tell us about the Snake River dams, what they are, and the problem that they create?
There are four dams on the lower Snake River, and this is between the city of Lewiston and the confluence of the Snake River in Columbia at the Tri-Cities. And so these four dams create a series of reservoirs across about 130, 140 miles of river. And the problem with the dams and the reservoirs is that they create sort of a worst case scenario for migratory fish like salmon and steelhead, as well as a bunch of other species. You know, the water is frequently too hot for fish that evolve to survive in cold mountain streams. It lacks current, which is a problem in particular for young fish that were historically just swept out to the ocean in the spring. And then, you know, there's the physical barrier of a dam itself. It's just hard to get fish safely around a dam, whether they're going upriver or downriver. And we've come up with all kinds of bizarre, sort of apocalyptic ways to do that. But in the end, it's not enough. So all told, the installation of hydropower dams on the Snake and also the Columbia have caused drastic declines in the numbers of wild salmon that return to the headwaters to spawn every year. And, you know, there are other factors contributing. You can think climate change, you know, ocean harvest to a degree, but multiple studies have pointed to the dams really as the leading cause of mortality.
And you were part of the Grand Salmon Project. This is a big project that still is moving. In my perception, the main action was, I think, in 2022. Can you tell us what the Grand Salmon Project is?
Yeah, so the Grand Salmon Project centered on this roughly 1,000-mile kayaking expedition. And so myself, Brooke Hess, and Haley Thompson paddled from the headwaters of the Salmon River in central Idaho through to the Columbia's confluence with the Pacific Ocean at Astoria. And our central purpose in taking on this sort of circus of a kayak expedition, which it really was a bit of a circus, we were advocating for dam breaching, breaching of the lower four Snake River dams, as well as we were also advocating for a moratorium on the proposed Stibnite gold mine. And this is also an incredibly important issue. Stibnite is a large-scale gold mine proposed to be reopened. It has historically been a gold mine, and it's proposed for reopening in the headwaters of the East Fork of the South Fork of the Salmon River. And so this, you know, when we talk about breaching dams and restoring a watershed, it's a little counterintuitive to think about restoring the lower parts of a watershed to a free-flowing state when you have a large-scale gold mine effectively poisoning the headwaters of that river system and some of the most sensitive habitat for spawning fish. And so, you know, in advocating for these couple big actions, we wanted to use kayaking, which is a sport that all three of us love and that has shaped our lives significantly, to advocate for, you know, a couple big, very necessary actions to protect some of the most important rivers and species in our region.
Let's keep talking about the Snake Dams. Those dams are still in play. They're still in the river. They're still holding back water. What can you tell us about the status of the push to get them breached? What you understand about where that entire movement's at and the likelihood that they will be breached?
The big update since I last talked with you is that back in December, there was an agreement reached between parties to ongoing litigation over the impacts of Columbia Snake River hydro system operations on endangered fish species. And that agreement is being called the Columbia River Basin Initiative, or CRBI. And the initiative is a roadmap for salmon recovery that was formed and agreed to by the six sovereigns. And this is a partnership between the states of Oregon and Washington, as well as the Nez Perce tribe, Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Nation, and the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation. Basically, this initiative lays out several actions that together are designed to restore anadromous fish species like salmon and steelhead, as well as other native fish, to abundance throughout the region. And also this agreement extends a stay in litigation for an additional 10 years while work is done to replace the services that are provided by the Lower Snake River dams. And that effectively lays out a path to dam breaching.
What's the timeline on that dam breaching? And I guess really the question is not about the timeline of dam breaching. Maybe the more unknown question is, what's the timeline for fish surviving this continued restriction on their access to the mountain waters? And I know they have access to the mountain waters. There's the upstream, the fish ladders, very complicated systems of the dams, but it's really the downstream action where they get blended, shredded in the in the turbines when they're young. What's the timeline on those fish being able to continue to survive this situation?
Yeah, you know, I think it's hard to put an exact number on that, but it's not long, right? You talk to anyone who knows sort of the state of the fisheries and, you know, the sort of the many pressures they're under, the dams being the largest pressure of them all, you're correct. It's not a long timeline. And, you know, some of these fish species are approaching really like functional extinction, right? They're not extinct. There are members of those species that are still running back and forth to the ocean. But, you know, if you have a limited enough number of fish, you just don't have dense enough populations to reproduce. And so, you know, there are still wild fish species running back into headwaters, like, you know, the middle fork of the salmon, you know, the upper south fork of the salmon, but they don't have long. And so something like this agreement, you know, that puts a timeline, it states that the Lower Snake River dams must be removed within 8 years. Whether or not that timeline is, you know, short enough to get those dams breached in time to save these species from extinction with all the increasing pressures of climate change, that kind of remains to be seen. And I think the other really challenging factor in there is that Congress still has to act to breach these dams. You know, the agreement itself cannot authorize breaching of those dams. And, you know, we all know that Congress is something of a mess these days in getting Congress to agree on anything, much less something that has been politically drummed up to be immensely divisive, even though it shouldn't be. Getting Congress to act on something like that may be very challenging. So that's a long way of saying, you know, it's a short timeline for these fish species, and our actions are you know, maybe going to happen quickly enough, and maybe they're not.
So to make sure I'm hearing this right, the Columbia River Basin Initiative has been established between the six sovereigns, the several tribes, and the states to create this agreement to move forward to hold back certain litigation, and that puts a timeline out there of 8 years. In that 8 year time frame, the dams have to be breached, but United States Congress still has to make the decision, make the action, I guess legal would be the term, that those dams are to also be breached.
That's correct. This is ultimately in Congress's hands.
And so the film is still being edited, worked through, produced, all these details. What's the plan on when that should be done and when it might go on tour and people can see it?
We are in the very last stages of post-production. So really all that needs to happen at this point is some final editing and then basically sound and color. And then we're hoping to have the film out into the world for a premiere at some point this spring or early summer. That is pending a bit more fundraising action on our part. Following that initial premiere, we are hoping to do a pretty decent impact campaign to sort of tour the film around, to use it as an advocacy lever to help get more people engaged in this issue, to get more people writing their congresspeople. And then we'll submit it to film festivals and get it kind of blasted out nationwide as broadly as we can.
You're going to put the film on tour when it comes time, and I recognize that you're in another fundraising stage. Tell me about the fundraising stage, what you're looking for, how people can engage, and I think there's a dry suit involved.
Yeah, so thank you for asking. We are in the very last stages of fundraising. You know, we've had an incredible sort of community rally of friends, river lovers, people donating, you know, $5, $10 a piece. That's added up to a pretty significant chunk of what we needed to fundraise. So, you know, we're immensely grateful for that. You know, and if folks out there are listening and are able to donate to get the last stage of the project off the ground, the donation links can all be found at our website, and that's salmonsourcetosea.com. And you are correct. Our friends at NRS did us a huge solid, and they have donated a dry suit. It's a giveaway. So folks can be entered into the giveaway for an NRS dry suit, which is huge. So big props to NRS for that one. They're amazing.
You know, they're funny enough, they're actually advertisers in this episode, which is
amazing.
Yeah, even better. Is there anything else you want to talk about with this, the Snake Dam project, the Snake River Dams?
I think what a lot of it has come down to for me, and the point that I keep coming back to, is that, you know, staying hopeful is kind of the centerpiece of this issue. And I think why we are committed to seeing this project through to the finish line, as far as, you know, the film goes, is that, you know, inspiring hope also inspires people to action. And so, you know, it is not too late. It is not too late for these dams to come out and for salmon populations in the Snake, in the Salmon River, to be restored to abundance. And I think it's important to remember that we all have agency. We can all write and call our congresspeople, and I hope other people feel that as well and take action as a result.
Excellent. Libby Toby, Grand Salmon Project, thank you for coming on the River Radius and giving us the Snake River Dam update.
Of course. Thank you, Sam.
For our last conversation about dams and rivers, we are joined by International Rivers, an organization working to prevent dam building globally. They are present on all continents and have a strong history of working with people and their rivers. Please meet Josh Klim from International Rivers.
My name is Joshua Klim. I'm based just outside of Washington, D.C.
And would you tell us who you work for, the organization, what you do, what that organization does in general?
Yeah, I'm the co-director at International Rivers. We're an international advocacy organization that's focused on defending rivers and defending the rights of communities that depend on them.
You know, this episode, we're looking at dams, where they are being taken out, where there's work to take out dams in the future, just exploring that topic of dams and rivers and what's going on. On the global scale, what is the trend with dams? Are they still going in around the world? Is there a change in that trend at all?
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting moment for rivers and for dams. Internationally, we've really seen that dams have started to fall out of favor. So we're really several years in the running, seeing basically a decline in new dams going up. Of course, that's of little comfort to those who are impacted and adversely, feeling the effects of the dams that are going up. But the trends really are in favor of rivers. And yes, we're seeing fewer dams being built. And also, excitingly, hopefully we're at the beginning of a new trend in dams actually coming out.
I know that at the COP events annual, the international annual gathering of people to talk about kind of climate and other factors around the planet, there's been a presence there where river advocates have been speaking loudly that dams are not clean energy, that they are something different. Is that part of the pressure that's creating this outcome where dams are falling out of favor?
Yeah, certainly. We're really seeing that through the decades, really, that community resistance and advocacy has been essential to preventing harmful dams from being built. And that will be key going forward in safeguarding the remaining free-flowing rivers that exist in the world. So that has really been critical. But there are also other factors as well. Certainly the cost of building new dams is prohibitive in most cases. So that is maybe the biggest factor as well, is just that dams are not as economical as they once had been, and that especially dams that are built for hydropower generation really can't compete on price with solar and wind. And that's really exciting. It's really a pivotal moment for rivers and for energy. I think actually 2022 was the first year that there was more solar installed globally than hydropower. And that's not just the amount that was installed during the year, that's more in history. So they've been building dams for 100 years. And just in the past couple of decades, solar has surpassed it. And that is a huge milestone and really kind of speaks to both the benefits of renewable energy, but also how hydropower just really can't compete, on a level playing field with renewable energy.
Can you explain some of the magnitude of these dams? We've heard about the Three Gorges Dam in China that was massive, and then the dam in Ethiopia, but just these huge structures that are going in, and it seems like again and again each new dam is outdoing the previous dam. Can you talk about the scale of these river dams that are happening?
There have been mega dams that have been built for decades. So, like you mentioned, the Three Gorges Dam that was built in the 1990s, and that remains actually the largest hydro project in the world for now. But the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam that was built on the headwaters of the Nile in Ethiopia, rivals that. It's not quite as large, but it is massive. And the amount of water that it is capable of retaining and, potentially constricting the flow to downstream countries in Sudan and Ethiopia fundamentally threatens those countries if Ethiopia were to withhold those volumes of water. So the scale of some of these projects remains massive. And actually, what would become the largest hydro project in the world is called the Grand Inga Dam that is proposed on the Congo River in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And this project has been kind of in the works for decades. If it were to be built, and if it were built to its full capacity, would effectively double the China Three Gorges Dam. It would be like 40 gigawatts of power, which is conceivably could power dozens of countries in Africa, except that, there are a lot of flaws with the project. And there's a reason that, every administration and the World Bank and China have wanted to support this project. They all see it as this great benefit, but the challenges are really too immense. So we haven't seen any progress on it. And to be honest, the really sad thing is that, by focusing on these mega projects that have a very limited, little chance of actually being built, we're ignoring much more practical, modest, medium to short-term solutions that are actually better able to deliver electricity. And actually, in the case of the Grand Inga Dam, the World Bank, which had long been the world's largest funder of dams, and effectively stopped funding dams for the past 10 years or so, is now kind of sniffing around the project. So we're starting to see the reemergence of some of these old dam promoters coming around when projects are proposed and there are billions of dollars.
Can you talk about that relationship between dam building and this idea that dams will modernize these countries and that they will bring them benefits? Things like the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, other players. I'll front load that a little bit, that in other readings and research I've done on that topic, that idea that dams are a modernization tool somewhat falls apart well after the dams come into play. Yeah, if you could talk about that some, please.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, really, the past century or more, mega dams have really been kind of portrayed and promoted by politicians as kind of the pinnacle of modernity. I was just recently in Guinea in West Africa, where the new highest denomination in the currency actually has a dam on the back.
Wow.
So it's a really kind of clear, concrete, demonstrable example of a politician who's now actually since been deposed saying, look what I've done. And I think that also kind of gives some insight into, the motivation around dam development, because it is as much about political prestige as it is about actually delivering some sort of development. And as you say, I mean, many of these projects that are, promoted and lauded, they end up saddling countries with debt. Dams take millions, if not billions of dollars to build, and basically all of that has to be spent up front. Often these dams do not deliver the amount of electricity that's been promised, and ultimately it's the corporate off-takers and the construction companies that are the real beneficiaries of these projects.
And they're frequently not, those construction companies and the folks building the dams are frequently not of that country where the dam is being built. They might be from another continent even coming in to make the money and then head out the door once the dam's done.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Most large hydro projects built today are financed and built by companies outside of the country, and predominantly China, actually, though that has reduced a bit, at least on the financing front, since COVID. But yeah, certainly, especially the corporate off-takers in Africa, in Brazil, in many contexts, we've seen large international mining companies coming in and paying and often underpaying for electricity because they have a huge, maybe aluminum smelter or something mm-hmm. that they want to build that is using all of this cheap electricity from hydropower that's being subsidized by taxpayers so that they can turn their bauxite into aluminum.
One of the questions we're asking in this episode around the United States is, and really like the focus is looking at a handful of dams that are coming out internationally. Are there any dams that are being removed? Are rivers becoming free flowing again? Is that a trend that has emerged? What's going on with that topic?
We haven't really seen much movement in terms of dam decommissioning and dam removal beyond Europe and North America so far, though there are a couple examples of typically much, much smaller dams. But that's, likely actually to change soon. If you remember last year, the dam disaster in Libya, where, over 10,000 people died, the dam collapse, I think, was a wake-up call,
right?
About the perilous condition, really thousands of aging dams around the world, or tens of thousands even. The peak of dam construction was, about 50 years ago. And, most dams were built to last, effectively 50 years before requiring significant kind of rehabilitation or, maintenance and repairs that often cost in the millions or tens of millions of dollars. So really kind of seeing that moment kind of arriving and those bills becoming due, where countries will have to decide whether to kind of patch up those dams and kind of keep them running longer, even if they're You know, many of them are obsolete and not actually providing any real value, or they have the option as well to consider removing the dams. And you know, so I think that's exciting that we have seen such momentum, you know, in the US, in Europe, and we can kind of look to those cases, the most recent and exciting maybe being the Klamath Dam in Northern California and Oregon, where, you know, really that's the largest dam removal. You know, I think we'll have a lot of lessons for other countries that are grappling with having these massive dams. You know, we haven't really seen a removal like that before. Like, how does it work in practice? And I think we'll be able to learn a lot of lessons about how it can be done, how much it costs, you know, what are some of the challenges, what are some of the solutions. And we'll be able to really kind of show that, yes, this is feasible and will end up saving countries money in the long run to actually take them down now. So it'll obviously be a struggle to make that case. The amount of money investment that's required to remove these dams is not for the faint of heart. And I think many, you know, politicians are happy to, you know, kind of patch things up and pass them along to the next administration. But, you know, really in terms of the long term, not only in cost, but also in ecosystem benefits and climate change adaptation, there's so many benefits to actually removing these dams. The organization I work with, International Rivers, we're beginning to pivot from fighting off destructive dams to actually talking about dam removal and really seeing that as the future of our work as fewer and fewer dams are being built.
It was interesting this morning. I woke up and saw the news that that dam burst in Kenya,
right,
and killed a bunch of people and obviously other damages as well. And yeah, it'll be interesting to watch what happens over the next few years, because I think it's harder to make that shift internationally.
That's definitely true. And what is maybe different is climate change really changes the calculus with a lot of these dams, that maybe these projects would be, you know, more or less okay if we weren't also seeing significant drought and significant flooding that is actually risking these dams collapsing altogether. Even last year in India on the Teesta River, we saw a brand new billion-dollar dam that was swept away when a glacial lake impacted by climate change floods washed away. You know, what took 5 years to build washed away in hours. So it's not even only the older dams that are at risk. We're talking about all the brand new ones as well.
Is there anything else you feel like we should talk about in this conversation?
Maybe one point to make is that I mentioned before that, you know, the trends are very much against new hydropower being built. The only, I think, wild card is climate change as a aggravating factor, that dam promoters are actually talking about how, you know, hydropower is necessary in their view to replace fossil fuels that need to be phased out or that we need to wean off of. And so there is, you know, you can be a bit sympathetic to that idea until you start looking at how these projects interact with climate change. So not only are they quite vulnerable to climate change, where, you know, we see countries like Brazil, the US, China, that are having to scramble when our reservoirs are dry and we can't produce power because of the climate change-induced drought. There are, of course, the examples where dams are threatened by climate change-induced floods, but all dams actually emit greenhouse gases, and that is unknown to the general public. You know, actually, in some places, especially the tropics in forested areas, the vegetation that gets submerged and ends up rotting in dam reservoirs turns into methane. It is among the worst greenhouse gases in terms of its impact. You know, if we are actually pivoting from fossil fuels to hydropower, we're not actually solving our problem, and are going to end up with kind of a methane bomb that's coming and will really upset a lot of the calculations about the amount of greenhouse gases that are being produced. It's really not a climate solution, and We're seeing that the vested interests are very much promoting hydropower as a climate solution, but thus far we've been largely successful in making sure that our scarce climate dollars are not used to build dams. But, you know, that is by no means guaranteed.
Josh Klim, International Rivers, thanks for coming on the podcast and telling us what's going on a global scale with dams and rivers.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
A free-flowing river-sized thank you goes out to all of our guests today, Nicole Haler and the Chattooga Conservancy, Libby Toby and the Grand Salmon Project, Wren Brownell and the Klamath River Renewal Corporation, Josh Klim and International Rivers. You can find links to all of these organizations in the show notes. And very importantly, thank you to Dave Perrin of the Chattooga River Basin and to Weston Boyles from Rios to Rivers for supporting my research into this episode. Today's sponsors are NRS, Paddleways, and the Denver area Nissan dealers. Find the Paddleways app for your phone in the App Store. They are offering 25% off for the paid subscription. To gain that subscription, do the checkout on their website after you download the app. Find NRS at NRS.com and in many of your local gear shops, and find your Denver area Nissan dealers at www.nissanusa.com. And for all of our sponsors, you can find their website and Instagram links in our show notes, in our link tree, and on our website. We have built two previous episodes on the Klamath River Dam removal projects, where we speak with Paddle Tribal Waters, and we built three previous episodes about the Snake River dams to include a full tour of Granite Dam and interviews with salmon experts. Those episodes are all linked in the show notes. All River Radius social media is supported by Samantha Seiss. All River Radius music comes from the lap steel guitar of Gene Reiniger. Be in touch anytime. Hello@theriverradius.com. Thanks so much for joining the River Radius.
You talk about separation anxiety. That was brutal.